Matthew 24. We have discussed how the first part of this chapter deals with the destruction of Jerusalem. Now as we start with verse 36, Jesus turns to his next and final coming. He said that he is going to return at the end of time, and he compares it in verse 38 to the time of Noah. People were thinking that life was normal. The Lord said they were eating, they were drinking, they were marrying, they were given in marriage until Noah entered into the ark. And then the flood comes and takes them all away. And then we looked at verses 40 through 42 last week. There were still a couple of things, though, that did not get covered. Verse 40 says, "Then shall two men be in the field. One is taken and one is left. Two women shall be grinding at the mill. One is taken and one is left. Watch therefore, for ye know not on what day your Lord cometh." And then we'll pick up with 43 in just a second. We said last week that a lot of people in the religious world, they will use the idea of two men and two women to say that this is going to be the rapture. Well, the Bible doesn't refer to a rapture. That's a Latin word that means snatch away. But here it is one illustration of a key point. And that is, when the Lord returns, there are going to be some who are... All right, there are going to be some who are unsaved. That would refer to the left, the people who are unrighteous. And then there are going to be some people who are saved. There are going to be some of the people who are righteous. And it's just a comparison. It's not designed to teach what sometimes today people claim. We didn't say too much about the mill. In our day and time, if we think about a mill, what comes to mind?
Grain.
All right, you think about grain. We think about some of the big structures in the past that people used to have. That wasn't really what was taking place in this day and time. There were no storage containers as we have in our day and time. So if people were going to try to make sure that something was going to be free of dirt, if no bugs were going to get in there, they had to go out and daily process their food. So if you're sick, well, you're probably not going to eat very well that day unless you have a friend who comes over and gives you some assistance. But these little mills, they were about the size of a dinner plate. Women typically were the ones who did the grinding. They would go out and clean the grain and this was a chief part of their diet. So they go out there, they make the fresh flour, get the fresh flour to make the fresh bread and so forth. And for these people, it was one more description of saying that when the Lord returns, people are going to be going throughout their daily lives. If you say today you've got a guy who's down at the shop, you've got the guy over here, he's at the office, you've got the housewife and she's doing her kind of thing, that's really what is being described here. We need to make sure that we have the right priorities. The Bible elsewhere describes that as living by faith, and there is a lot of focus here on watching. Jesus continues to come back to talk about watching. He uses the present tense again and again. He says, we can't know. Perfect tense, man has never been able to know when the Lord's going to come. But he is going to return, and even if we could know the day and time, we still have the obligation to be faithful. One other quick note, then we'll see if there's anything that you want to add or ask, and then pick up briefly with verses 43 and 44. If you listened as I read the verse, then that's 42. Some translations say hour, and that would be the King James translation. Other versions like the ASV use the word day, and that difference is because of a manuscript variation. But it doesn't change the point. Whether you're talking about the day or the hour, the point is we're not going to be able to predict when he's going to come. Anything that you want to contribute before we read Matthew 24, 43 and 44? Okay. In the 43rd verse, he continues, and this will close out the paragraph in the ESV. But know this, that if the master of the house had known in what watch the thief was coming, he would have watched, and would not have suffered his house to be broken through. Therefore be ye also ready, for in an hour that ye think not, the Son of Man comes. Who or what's a thief? What's a thief? All right, someone who steals from you or from someone else. At least some in this assembly have been exposed to a thief. Maybe it was when we were home. Maybe it was when we were not at home. But a thief breaks through to steal. And generally, thieves try to do that when people are not expecting it. They're going to maybe strike during the day. Perhaps they've watched the house for a little while. Maybe they drive through the neighborhood looking to see who doesn't have a burglar alarm sign. But they try to do it when nobody's going to be home or nobody's going to catch them. Well, Jesus used this fact, this illustration, to describe his next and second coming. Remember, he goes back there in about 37 and 38, he refers to his coming at the end of time as being like Noah. You think those people were expecting a flood? No. Life was, going on. There was no, big set of rain clouds in the sky, anything like that. To them, life was absolutely normal. You also see here, I think, a contrast with the destruction of Jerusalem. As we went through Matthew 24 earlier, and we pointed out sign after sign after sign. Remember the wars, the rumors of wars, the earthquakes, the various upheavals, lots of signs. But Jesus now says concerning his next and final coming, there will not be those kinds of things. Peter, Paul, various writers, they described it as like a thief. 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 10. Paul, in 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 3, said that people are going to be unprepared for it. It's going to be like labor pains that come upon a woman. And then you have this statement. We're going to deal with some of the things Sunday, likely, that we talked about last Wednesday as far as matters related to Jesus' next and final return. But there was a passage that we didn't use last Wednesday, but we are going to likely look at Sunday. It's Luke 18. Luke 18, verse 8. Now, this is a curious passage. It's one of the passages that preachers often like to discuss. And there are a couple of ways to look at it, but in the end, I think you still come out to basically the same point or thought. Luke 18, verse 8. Anyone there and want to read it? Luke 18, verse 8. Betty?
I tell you that he will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man cometh, shall he find faith on the earth?
Okay. A few people interpret that as a destruction of Jerusalem. I think that's a stretch. Assuming that it's not the destruction of Jerusalem and it is his next and final coming. What does that verse indicate? When he returns, is he going to find faith where? On earth. Now, in the Greek text, there's actually a definite article. And this is one of the things that complicates the point a little bit. Jesus says, when he comes, is he going to find the faith on earth? Well, knowing that the definite article is used there, what would it indicate about the thought? What's the faith? All right, one, the faith that's described in the gospel, Christianity as it's described in the scriptures. And the question, whether you look at that as, is he going to find the faith here, or will he find faith in the sense of people following Christ? What does that question seem to suggest? Yeah. I mean, you think about a flood or some other kind of disaster coming to an area. It's been announced over the news for 2 days. And somebody says, you think we'll find any food on the grocery store shelves? What are they asking by that question? It's a little doubtful that there's not going to be a lot. The shelves may not be completely empty, but there's not going to be nearly what there could be under normal circumstances. This verse, and as I said, it's a passage which a lot of people wonder about, but it's a passage which inclines a lot of people to think that as far as the degree of religion on the earth, there may not be a lot of that, or at least there may not be a lot of people who are really trying to do what's right and truly following God. But you can make that point now, could you not? When you look at the world, as far as our society and culture, I mean, church attendance is in decline. I talked to one preacher yesterday. He's in his mid-60s, and he said when he was growing up, I'm guessing that probably would be in the 20 to 30 year age bracket, he said 60% of people or so were religiously inclined. But if you look at that number today, we've probably dropped down to between 30 and 40%. In the last 30 or 40 years, we have really declined as far as interest in spiritual things. And, you know, if the world is still here in 30, 40, 50 years, what's it going to be like? I don't know. But there's no sign that people are headed back towards spiritual things, at least from where I sit in this country. So, at least in the immediate future, if things continue to progress, it doesn't look all that positive. But still, we need to continue to be faithful regardless of what happens. Anything that you want to add or ask about before we pick up with 45 through 47, Stan? Are we in Luke 18?
Yes.
Okay. And that's one of the difficulties with that passage. I mean, it is, you find, if we go back to verse 1, he talks about prayer. I think tonight as we, well, let's just jump a little bit ahead of myself. Let's look at Mark 13 before we start there. Now, I cite Mark 13 because it is a brief parallel to what we're looking at in Matthew 24, especially what we're going to see in verses 45 through 47. Looking at about verse 34. We'll start with 32 because that's where the paragraph begins in the ESV. That's chapter 14. 33 in Mark 13. Take heed, watch and pray. Now notice that word pray. If you compare that with what we find in Luke 18, and he spake a parable unto them to the end that they ought always to do what? To pray. Kind of interesting that the subject of prayer is introduced in Luke 18, verse 1. Then he gets to Luke 18, 8. But as we look at the parallel in Mark 13:33 and following, he also talks about watching and praying. Then he says, "For ye know not when the time is. It is when a man sojourning in another country, having left his house and given authority to his servants, to each one his work, commands also the porter to watch." So as you get down to the latter part of Mark 14, he talks about this. And then over in Luke 18, let's read that as well. "He spake a parable unto them that they'd always to pray and not to faint." Then he gives a story about the widow and the judge. The judge didn't fear God, regarded not man. That's kind of interesting too, is it not? Because when we look at Mark 13 and Matthew 24, what's the attitude of people concerning religion? Back there, like the days of Noah. They're self-absorbed. They're thinking about secular things. The judge didn't fear God, regarded not man. There was a widow in the city. She often came to him, asked to be avenged of her adversary. And he said, verse 4, "I don't fear God. I don't regard man." But yet, the continual coming of this woman wearied him, so he finally gave in to her. And then 6, Jesus says, "Hear what the unrighteous judge says." And then in 7, "And shall God not avenge his elect?" Well, there have been various times when God has done that, but certainly that will be true at the end of time, where he's going to pay people back for what they've done, "that cry to him day and night, and yet he is long-suffering over them. I say unto you that he will avenge them speedily." Well, in our minds, the second coming has not been quick, but with God, time operates on a little bit different scale. He says, "Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes," that is, to avenge the people, "will he find faith on earth?" So there are some similarities there, but it's also a little abrupt, as you mentioned. He just kind of sticks that in, and that has been a little bit perplexing to folks. But that has to refer to something. So if you don't take the reference to Jesus' next and final coming, the only thing I know to do is somehow put it with the destruction of Jerusalem, which really doesn't seem to fit there. But there are some parallels as you start looking through that with prayer and so forth. Anybody else? Okay, let's head back to Matthew 24 and now see what we find in verses 45 through 47. And I need to flip back over there as well. 45, "Who then is a faithful and wise servant, whom his Lord hath set over his household to give them their food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his Lord, when he cometh, shall find him," or find so doing. "Verily I say unto you that he will set him over all that he hath." When we think about the Lord's next and final coming, Jesus seems to have thought of it as so significant that he warns about it repeatedly throughout his ministry. Especially though here at the end of Matthew 24 and into Matthew 25, he brings up this idea again and again and again. Be prepared, be cautious, be careful, pray about it, think about it, live as he might return at any possible time. Now as he switches gears a little bit, he says at his return there are going to be basically two categories of people when we deal with accountable folks. There are going to be some people who, as we think of them in terms of stewardship, how would we describe them? They're going to be, all right, they're going to be faithful and wise. What would that second category be? If you're not faithful, you are unfaithful. If you're not wise, you are unwise. You fail to discern. You have failed to make the appropriate preparations for his next and final coming. The people who are wise, verse 46, they're compared to what kind of thing? You have here a fellow who's... Okay. He is blessed. Is there anything else as far as the illustration there? All right, he's doing the will of God.
Does that kind of answer the question, though, that there will be faithful if he's doing the will of God when God comes, or when Christ comes?
Yeah. I think you have to argue that there will be at least some people who are going to be in a right relationship with God. Paul, as he talked about that in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 16 and 17, remember he says, "Then we that are alive shall be caught up with Christ." So Paul's writing by inspiration, and he indicated that when the Lord returns, there will be some righteous. Well, that's also true of Noah, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Not many people, but at least there were some. And when you consider that in the context of Luke 18:8, will the Son of Man find faith on earth? It's like, again, the grocery store illustration. You might not like tuna, but you can maybe find a loaf of bread, a few cans of tuna, and a couple of the things down on aisle 6. So that almost to me seems to be the state of the world. I mean, you know, we're not making predictions here as far as when he's going to come, but things don't look all that good or all that favorable. And even now, when you look at the number of people in the world and the number of people who are truly committed to God, it's not good. Anybody see the Facebook post today? That's how I first saw it, about the congregation in Chattanooga, the Ridgeway Church. Well, they've got, I don't know if she was a member or not, but a girl who became involved with the same-sex relationship, the parents became supportive of it in a public way, and the congregation, you know, essentially came out and said to the parents, you know, you can't do this. You know, we recognize that you love your child and whatnot, but we can't have you as a member of the congregation going out and, you know, endorsing this kind of thing. And Ridgeway has been hit hard. The national media, if you've not seen the story yet in the national media, you should within the next 24 hours if you watch the news. I mean, they just went after them in the worst kind of way. It's one thing not to be religious, but it's another thing to really try to attack the people who are doing right. And that's, for the most part, where we seem to be as a society. If we'll not cave in to what the world wants, then we're going to be just like a bulldog. You know, Doberman come after you and attack you.
There was also a tweet that said from one of the guys on the Duck Dynasty, the star on the Duck Dynasty, about abortion.
I didn't see that.
So what has our society come to? This question.
Yeah. Well, and that's true. We saw, I think, the story about the shooting in Oklahoma. And the reporters are asking, what would cause people to do that? Well, I got a good answer. Sin. But, I mean, to actually gun down a person in cold blood just to see what it's like or just for the fun of it? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's some world. It doesn't look like it's getting better anytime soon. Anybody else want to make a comment there? Okay, let's go back and pick up a couple other things here. As you look back in verse 45, another part of the illustration, Jesus talks about the faithful and wise servant. And what happens to this fellow? The Lord says His Lord does what? All right, makes him a ruler. And this was something that happened in that day and time. There were people, wealthy people, who would go away from the home for a while, and they'd want somebody to kind of house it. You manage the household. Now, today, a lot of times, that household is going to be empty, but in this day and time, they had servants and a lot of other things. So that's where you see the feeding the people in the home in due season. If you've got some servants, and the master leaves and you don't feed the guys that are the servants, are you a faithful servant? You're starving the people. So that's not right. So the various tasks that would have been involved with this, that's what Jesus is talking about in 45. We remember a couple of passages, I think, 1 Corinthians 4:2. Here, moreover, it is required in stewards that a man be found faithful. And then also in Revelation 2, verse 10, we've heard that many times, be thou faithful, even if you have to die, even to the point of death. And then the crown of life is promised there. And here, the statement is, if you're faithful, what's going to be the blessing of the reward? 47. Verily I say unto you that he will set him over how much? All that he's got. You've got someone who was faithful during your absence, and if we're faithful to Christ, there is going to be a great, great reward. Well, we have various texts when it comes to congregations as well as individuals. We make the decision whether or not we're going to be faithful to God in every area of life, or we're going to be unfaithful. And that choice doesn't mean that we're going to live a perfect life, but it does mean that we're going to head our life in a direction where we either seek to do God's will on a regular basis, or we do not. You remember what Peter said in 2 Peter chapter 2, verses 20 through 22? There is the kind of person, he becomes a Christian, but he or she decides to leave the faith. He says that last state is worse than the first. And he compares that with a vomit illustration. It's like that dog that returns to its own puke or vomit. So that's a very, very bad thing. We do not want to be classified as an unfaithful servant. We can, though, be classified in that way if, number one, we become a Christian and we return to the old way of life. Or we can be an unfaithful servant if God has given us life and we have failed to live it in a way that is consistent with what he says. I want to go a different direction here for a little bit, and we'll need some helpers as far as cross-references, but let's see if there's anything that you want to add or ask. Okay, the idea of a reward is introduced as we look at verses 45 through 47. If you're faithful, then you're going to receive a reward. And Jesus has talked about this in some other passages, Matthew 25, 21. If you skip over a page, there he says, his Lord said unto him, well done, good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will set thee over many things. Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord. And then in Luke 16, verses 10 and 11, he says the same kind of thing. Then as you study this particular topic, you find in the Bible some passages which do refer to what Christians will receive or the saved will receive in eternity. Now, there's not a lot here as far as things which you can say, well, okay, it's going to be exactly this or it's going to be exactly that. But there is apparently enough there to draw, I think, at least some basic conclusions. So let's start lining up some helpers to think about if we're faithful, as Jesus talks about at the end of Matthew 24 and as he talks about in Matthew 25 with the five foolish virgins, the five wise virgins. Let's kind of see what he has planned for some folks. You'll have plenty of time to get to the references, Matthew 5, verse 12, Brian. And then after that, let's take a look at 2 John 8, Steve. Then we'll look at James 1, verse 12, Lois. And after that, we'll look at Matthew 13, 43, Josh. Well, let's start with that first reference, Matthew 5, verse 12.
Rejoice and be exceeding glad, for great is your reward in heaven, for so persecuted the prophets, who were before you.
Now that's an interesting passage. When you think about giving a great reward to somebody, for a two-year-old, that might be a lollipop. But when you think about God saying, I have a great reward, or a great reward is available, that kind of puts a different spin on it, doesn't it? I mean, God, he's the owner of all. What in his mind would be a great reward? I don't know. But when God says to his people, if you're faithful, a great reward is possible, that should get our attention. Man, you know, make us, okay, well, that's good news. Well, let's see some other passages. This is a curious verse that's going to be read next, and we probably in this life will not fully understand it. But 2 John 8.
Look to yourselves that ye lose not the things which ye have wrought, but that ye receive a full reward.
Okay. What kind of reward? You can receive a full reward. Well, I'm not sure exactly what would be less than that, but that seems to imply that you can lose part of it. Or it can be reduced somehow. Now, there may be various ways for that to occur. I don't know. But as we think about this, it's possible to have a great reward, and it's also possible to have a full reward. Now, somebody says, well, okay, I'm interested in those things. What kind of life do I have to live? What are some of the things that I need to be involved with to make sure that I have a true reward from God for eternity? Let's look at James 1, verse 12. One of the things that is maybe not stated all that often by those who teach, but I think it may be something that people kind of secretly believe, is that unless you are some high-profile person in the church, you're not going to get much of a reward. You know, God's reward is just for those key people, if you will. But the Bible doesn't teach that. And we don't want to believe that because it's not right. Here, what does the Bible say? Those who have... proven to be genuine... And when it comes to temptation, what have they done? They have been able to withstand it. There's going to be a reward for those people. Well, how many folks get tempted? If you're going to become a Christian, if you're going to be old enough to be accountable, you're going to be tempted. So when we think about this, as far as we live our life, this is one more demonstration of faithfulness, is it not? Here's something that comes along that's wrong. You have the ability to choose whether to partake of it or not. The Bible associates a reward with that, specifically a crown. All right, then this passage, which is also unique, Matthew 13, 43.
Then the righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father. He who has ears, let him hear.
Okay, I'm not sure I fully understand that verse. But when Jesus talks about the righteous, he compares it to what? Shining like the sun. Now, we're a good ways away from the sun, but when you think about that promise, being able to shine as brilliantly or like the sun, that is a magnificent promise. All right, then there's some other things. Let's line up our next set of helpers. Matthew 10, verse 41. Who wants to take care of that one? Matthew 10, verse 41. And you have time to get there, Harvey. All right, and then Betty, we will ask you to go over to Hebrews 11, verse 6. Revelation 2:10. Josh? After that, we'll look at 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 8. 2 Timothy 4, verse 8. Brian? And then we'll head somebody over to 1 Thessalonians 2, verses 19 and 20. 1 Thessalonians 2:19 and 20. Jenny, thank you. And then Matthew, who's my Matthew 10:41 reader? Okay, I'm going to ask you to stay there, and then we'll get to Matthew 10:42 as well after that. Let's also look at 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 4. 1 Peter 5, 4. All right, and our last one is going to be Matthew 6, verse 20. Matthew 6, verse 20. Ray, you want to take that one? Oh, don't have your glasses. Okay, Tim's got it. All right, thank you. Matthew 6, verse 20. Now, here is a list of passages which will switch gears for us a little bit. We looked at some of the things that are associated with a reward, but now we're going to look at a slightly different subject. And you'll see the point beginning with Matthew 10, verse 41. Harvey?
He that receiveth a prophet in the name of the prophet shall receive the prophet's reward. And he that receiveth a righteous man in the name of the righteous man shall receive a righteous man's reward.
Okay. Now, it seems to me, as I look at this passage, that Jesus is offering a distinction. There appears to be a reward for a prophet. There also appears to be a reward for a righteous man. Well, that's good news, isn't it? Not everybody's a prophet. We don't have any prophets here. But if we're a righteous person, there's also a reward for that. Now, exactly what is that going to be? I don't know. Might it be a crown for those that endure temptation? James 1, verse 12. Might it be like shining as the sun? We're not given a lot of specifics about that, but we do have these statements which should encourage us. All right, then let's pick up with Hebrews 11, verse 6.
And without faith it is impossible to be well pleasing unto him. For he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that seek after him.
Think about the end of that verse. God is a rewarder for the people who seek after him. Isn't that good news? We may never teach a Bible class. We may be old and sick by the time we become a Christian, and can't do very much as far as works. But can we seek after God? We can. The Bible says for the people who do that, they have a reward from God. Now maybe some of that's in this life, but it also seems to be something that will have some application in eternity. Revelation 2:10.
Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison, that you may be tested. And for 10 days you'll have tribulation. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life.
Okay, does the crown of life go to everybody? Well, eternal life will, but I don't know about what's described concerning the crown of life. But there are some people that John says, and maybe everybody that will be in eternity, are promised this crown. And it's not the only time that we read about the idea of a crown. All right, who else? 2 Timothy 4, verse 8. All right, the people who love Christ appearing, you think, well, I just love Jesus is enough to get the crown? No. When he says the people who have loved his appearing, who's that? It's a metonymy. He's saying this, but he means something else. Who's he describing? People who love Christ or the people who? All right, people who obey him, the people who have served him. So is this a different crown? Is this the same crown? I don't know. But it is described as being something associated with a reward. So if we're just faithful, there's a reward. Well, let's see what else is associated with being given to the people who are trying to do what's right. 1 Thessalonians 2, 19 and 20. A different kind of work here. Jenny? 1 Thessalonians 2, 19 and 20.
For what is our hope or joy or crown of boasting before our Lord Jesus at his coming? Is it not you? For you are our glory and joy.
Okay. Paul says we're going to have a crown. And then he turns right around and says, what will that crown be? It's going to be you. You're the fruit of our evangelistic labor. You're going to be our crown. Well, that seems to be a little bit different than Revelation 2:10. Be thou faithful unto death, and I'm going to give you a crown of life. So that takes us back to kind of where we started as far as Matthew 10:41. You know, there's a reward for a righteous man. There's a reward, or we could say woman. There's going to be a reward for the prophets and so forth. So you see here a lot of different things. Let's pick up, Harvey, back to you, Matthew 10:42, and then we'll look at 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 4.
And whosoever shall give to drink unto one of these little ones a cup full of water, only in the name of the disciples, verily I say unto you, he shall in no wise lose his reward.
Okay. Well, that's another important passage. Sometimes I'm convinced that we've got a lot of people. in the church who do some things that they regard as really small. I lock up the building. I turn off the copier. I open up the building. I clean off the sidewalk. I clean the children's toys from class. Things that some people might regard, they're important, but some people might regard them as menial. But when we look at the passage here, what's Jesus say? You've taken a cup of cold water. That's about as simple as it gets, isn't it? And the Lord says, if you do that, you will in no wise lose your reward. So as we do those small tasks for others, maybe it involves a church building, the Lord says, I'm watching. It all goes back here to Matthew 24. We have, remember, two kinds of people. There are the faithful people, and there are the unfaithful people. If we're accountable, we fall into one category or the other. So we need these verses, I think, to be brought out at various times to encourage us. All right, 1 Peter 5, verse 4. Okay, now here again is the idea of a crown, but it's presented from yet a different perspective. It is a crown of glory. And who's he talking to in this context? Elders. Well, you think the people that shed some tears and spent some time serving as an elder did something that was unique? Yeah. Appropriate to recognize them for the work? Sure. Now, does that mean that he's going to disregard the person that, came in and laid the carpet? No. But people do different things. And all these things that people do are going to be recognized. And then to sum it up, we have what Jesus said in Matthew 6, verse 20.
But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust doth corrupt, and where thieves do not break through nor steal.
And now this is another passage that puzzles me a little bit. Lay up treasures, plural, in heaven. What would those be? I have no idea. Does that maybe tie into the different references to crowns? I have no clue. But the one thing that does seem pretty sure in my mind is that, once again, when you have a faithful steward doing various things and recognized and repaid for that. So, Paul, remember 1 Corinthians 15, 58? Should jot that passage down. Be ye steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, for you know that your labor is not in vain. It might seem like that in this life. People might say, well, nobody ever cares, nobody ever appreciates, nobody ever recognizes what I do. That might be true. But the labor is not in vain. There is a reward for the things that we do. Anybody want to say something about that, Stan?
Question. In Matthew 19:21, where it tells the rich young ruler, he says, I shall have treasure in heaven. Is he saying to the rich young ruler, you're laying up treasure in heaven, or your reward will be a treasure that's already in heaven?
I don't know that you could separate those two with much of a fine line, but I certainly would say the first one would seem to be the case, where if you're willing to do this, that's going to be very productive and beneficial for you in the afterlife. But I would think that both ideas could be taken from that passage. So, whatever we spend as far as time, money, resources, intellect, God says, I see it all. And it's just like, and maybe this is not the best biblical illustration, but it's like you're building up a bank. Matthew 6, verse 20. And how all that plays out in the end, I have no clue. But God is a fair and righteous judge, so whatever is right, whatever is proper, and the people who are in heaven, I think it's also fair to say that nobody's going to be disappointed. It's just going to be different.
Well, if it were meant that he would be laying up treasure, assume any range of values, but if the treasure is his reward, it's another verse that would indicate to us that the same as the verse that says great is your reward. It would seem to indicate that that's one that we can fall back on. We can rely on. It's going to be.
Yeah, and that's why I say, we don't know exactly what that is. When you think about some of Jesus' teachings, for example, he talks about the fellow who was, faithful with this number of pounds, or he was faithful over this number of cities. You have some variation there as far as, Not everybody got 10 cities. Not everybody got the same number of pounds. So exactly how that works out, two points of caution there. For us, when we think about treasure in heaven, oftentimes we think in very, you know, materialistic terms. You know, I've got a mansion and I've got two gold doors, you've only got one. Or mine's gold and you're silver. I don't think that we're looking at that kind of thing. And the second point is, people can sometimes have an improper motivation. I want lots of stuff in heaven, so I'm going to do these things now. That's not the way the system is set up. But the system is set up in such a way where it emphasizes faithfulness and really not much concentration, if you will, on a reward. You know, that God's going to do what's right, whatever is proper. But there does seem to be, as you look at these passages, enough information to conclude that there is going to be some kind of distinction. And for us, even from a common sense standpoint, I don't know that I've met too many Christians, you know, that would want to be recognized in the same way that Paul was. I mean, I can't imagine a Christian being comfortable with that because he did some different things. And that's not to say that other people did things that were really any less important. They were just different. Anybody else? Right?
We talk or we hear of people that retire from a job or from two or three jobs, mm-hmm. and they get the retirement. Is there such a thing as two rewards? Or is it, how would you speak on that?
My current thinking is, and again, this goes out there a little bit in a limb, I'm thinking in terms of one reward, as far as this is what you receive, but it might be a multifaceted reward. And I guess that would be just the easiest way that I could lay that out, is that there could be different components to it.
Yeah, I can't think of anything else other than that, because the reward is a reward.
Yeah.
How little or how big it is.
Yeah. I mean, almost like Christmas presents.
Right.
You could have somebody that gets one big gift, and then you could have somebody else that gets 10. We sometimes see that same kind of thing with birthday presents. You know, this is the time for the presents. But in one case, it's going to be this. In another case, it's going to be this. And all designed to be for the same time or the same occasion. So that seems to be the picture that I get. And 2 Corinthians 5:10, we shall all be made manifest before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may receive the things done in the body. So it seems like, okay, this is based on how you've lived, what's appropriate for you. But never feel like, regardless of what you do in the church, that your work is unimportant or it's not going to be rewarded. There is that possibility for all people for a full reward. And I think it's fair to say that nobody is going to be disappointed with what they receive. But there are going to be likely some differences associated with it. Betty? Okay, I'll take Betty first and then Harvey.
So how do you fit the parable in of the worker that started for many a day, and as they progressed,
number one, if it refers to what people were receiving in heaven, then you have some difficulty there. The only way to answer that in my mind would be that you would say everybody's going to receive eternal life, and that is the gift. I'm not sure, though, in my mind that refers to what people are going to receive in eternity. One example of that would be that, as far as an alternative view, would be that he refers to Jews and Gentiles. You know, there are some people that show up earlier or later. But still, if you show up at this point or at this point and you're faithful, it's still possible to receive that full reward, 2 John 8. So, again, if you can conclusively show that that passage deals with heaven and what people are going to receive, then that would be a passage that would mitigate or argue against, at least to some degree, what we've set forth. But with all the other passages, these additional verses in my mind would say, let's go back and relook at that. And do we really have that point being taught there, or might it be something else?
I kind of look at it as a reward in this respect, no matter how great or how small. It's just by grace that we got the reward.
Yes. And that's true. And that would be, I guess, we talked about a couple things with Stan as far as follow-up points, and that would be the other thing as well, which actually goes back to kind of a heart attitude. When we use the word reward, sometimes, in this life at least, we associate that with our efforts. Well, look at what I did. Isn't it in Luke 17, 20 and 21, Let's just take a quick look there and see if that's right. That's not it. I was thinking, even so, ye also, when ye shall have done all the things that are commanded, you say, we are unprofitable servants, we have done that which it was our duty to do. I'm going to have to think about where that is, or we can pull it out for next week. But he did say that. After we've done all the things that we've been commanded to do, at the end of the day, we're still unprofitable servants. Thus, any idea that, well, we've earned this, God, or now it's time for you to go ahead and pay us back. No. Ephesians 2, 8 and 9, for by grace have you been saved. So when we talk about that word reward, we need to make sure that we're using it, not as the world uses it, not that we deserve it, but that this is God's, the Bible does use the word reward, but not in that bad sense. This is God's response to us for having been a faithful servant. And that's what we see in Luke 24, or Matthew 24, verses 45 through 47. You've been faithful, and now I'm reacting to that. And here is what is right. Here's what is appropriate for you. Anybody else? Brian, and then Stan, I saw your hand.
It seems like Luke 12 is sort of a parallel on some of this. This is 41 down to 48. And it seems to go into the aspect more of the reward in a bad sense for the unfaithful one. And I think it's interesting that, you know, it says in verse 47, that servant who knew his master's will and did not prepare himself to do according to his will shall be beaten with many stripes. But he who did not know and committed things deserving of stripes shall be beaten with few. So the degree of reward goes on the full scale for the faithful or unfaithful. There's distinctions that are appropriate based on faithfulness.
Yeah. For example, you think about I learned within the last week or so about a preacher not too far from here that decided to run out on his wife, shack up with a woman with three kids. Now you think about that fella, here's a guy trained as a gospel preacher, preached for a number of years. What would you say he's been entrusted with? A little or a lot? I mean, if you know enough to, you know, be a full-time preacher and, you know, you can put out enough material for several years, I mean, you've been given a lot. And then if you decide to, you know, do what some of the people in the world have done, unless he repents, the passage that you cited would seem to me to have a lot of reference there that, I mean, he's going to suffer and suffer greatly. But here you have a situation where nobody's ever heard the word. You know, they get married, and after 6 months, they're not content with the wife, and they just figure, well, you know, my idol God doesn't have anything to say about that. He doesn't care. I'll just go out and find another woman. Well, his level of knowledge would be a whole lot less than the preacher who's been exposed to the gospel, who's been able to teach the gospel and so forth. And that, to me, would be a specific situation that would tie in here. And you're right, that greater level of responsibility. So that's got to be a factor, too, on both sides of the fence when we think about what's going to happen in eternity. You know, when you think about, as I said, preachers, they have the ability to do more. You have some other people in the congregation who have the ability to do more. And even congregations. When you think about a congregation of our size and a congregation of 3,000, you know, the congregation of 3,000, would you say that they have some more responsibility? Yeah. I mean, they've got more people. They've got more funds. They have probably a little more talent there and so forth. So on a congregational level, there will also be that basis for judgment. And, you know, when you think about people that are in Africa, some other third world countries, fewer things there that they had to work with. So, again, they can be faithful in what they have. But with the things that we have here, there's going to be a great deal of responsibility that we will need to answer for. Stan?
Two things. One, I think we need to emphasize, just so that people understand where we're at here, that the reward that we were talking about prior to Brian's comments, the things that are for faithful servants, that we need to emphasize that. That is the case. You've got to be a servant. You've got to be an obedient servant before any of that, no matter what that reward is affected. Second thing is a question, and you just brought that up. The individual who has been a faithful servant and has done much, such as you mentioned in the preacher's case, and then attorney for whatever reason, if he should repent and come back, has his reward been affected?
I don't know. I mean, there was a period of time where he would be classified as one of the unfaithful, but everybody loses some opportunities. Now, this guy, he may have lost an opportunity for 10 years. This guy loses an opportunity for a day. How all that factors out, I don't know. All I can say is that God is righteous, and we want to seek to be as faithful as we can. People sometimes say, well, what does faithfulness mean? Well, look at it in terms of a husband and wife. You know, what does it mean for a husband to be faithful to his wife and vice versa? And it's something that we want to go ahead and seek to be when it comes to God and spiritual things, something we're doing every day.